Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Geo v. Hicks.
May it please the court, Mr. Asher. This case is a workers' compensation subrogation suit which was brought by New York Underwriters, a subsidiary of Hartford. I may make Freudian slips referring to them as Hartford during the argument. It is brought pursuant to Article 8307, Section 6A of the Texas Statutes, the Workers' Compensation Subrogation Statute. In deciding this case, there are a few points about the statute and about the nature of this cause of action that are vitally important to be understood. Number one being that 8307 Section 6A has as its legislative intent reducing the burden of insurance on the public of Texas and reducing that burden to the employers in Texas. Secondly, it gives specific and peculiar subrogation rights to a workers' compensation carrier above and beyond those owned by an injured party in a third-party traditional personal injury case.
Is this basic scheme still in place now under the new Workers' Comp Act?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The basic scheme has not changed at all. The only aspect of 8307-6A which has changed in new Article 4.05A of the new Act is attorney's fees are no longer awarded on futures to plaintiff's attorneys. The rest of it is in place. In addition, the Act was not created for the benefit of claimants. It was not created for the benefit of third-party tortfeasors or claimants' attorneys. It was solely for the benefit of carriers. And it is an oft-misunderstood statute. It is truly the last and best tool that this ailing industry has in our state in order to recover and recoup benefits that have been paid out to help reduce premiums and the burden on the insurance industry. Now, the Court of Appeals below has dealt this tool a serious death blow, and this is why. Workers' compensation cases traditionally have been of three types. The first being what I will call the normal comp case. Most of you are familiar with it. It is a comp case in which a claim is filed after the E1, there is a CSA, and the claim is concluded. There has never been any question in our state following the law of Brooks versus Lucky that in that instance, the cause of action for the carrier accrues on the date that the CSA is approved, not just signed, but approved.
Is that even when the insurance company makes weekly payments preceding the entry of the CSA?
That's true, Your Honor. In fact,
when is the right of the insurance company to make a subrogation claim accrue? Wouldn't it accrue with the first payment?
Technically, Your Honor, and this case has been this issue has been gotten into by various courts with respect to the issue of whether or not the claimant has compromised the carrier's subrogation right by releasing the third party. And what they say is that the cause of action accrues upon the filing of a claim, even though they haven't paid out one cent. But the cause of action matures on the date that they have made payments. However, I'm going to distinguish for you the difference between accruing and maturing and the statute of limitations, and the difference is quite vital. So the first scenario is the CSA, the ordinary comp claim. The second comp claim I'm going to refer to as a controverted claim. The court below has referred to it, the Court of Appeals that is, has referred to it as a contested claim, and I think that's a misnomer for reasons I'll get into. A controverted claim is a claim where benefits are paid out, and for some reason, part or all of it is controverted, and the case is appealed to the district court, and you have a judgment or a settlement. In those cases, there has been no question that the statute of limitations begins to run for the carrier on the date of the judgment or the settlement. That's given to us by Campbell versus Sanford and Fidelity Union versus Texas Power and Light. The third case that courts have dealt with in our state, in the third scenario, is a death case. And there has never been any question, and is not today any question, that statute of limitations for carriers begins to run on the date of payment number one. Because in death cases, you have clear, unequivocal statutory benefits that are paid out from day one to day end. And that's the case of Buss versus Robeson in 1952. That case is vital and is alive today, although as you will see, I believe the court below has misinterpreted the case. Now, the Court of Appeals below has stated, and we agree, that this case must be decided based
when,
on the...
When did the death case start running?
The date of the first payment, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals admits, and we agree, that the 73 Amendment did not change prior case law. For purposes of the carrier's cause of action and the statute of limitations, it is still in place. And they also say, and we also agree, that this case must be decided consistent with those prior decisions.
Shouldn't this case also be decided consistent with other limitations cases in terms of when the injury to the when the cause of action accrues?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And the reason is very vital to our whole the whole theme here, and that is in traditional personal injury cases, which my adversary will no doubt cite to you, the claimant's cause of action prior to the 73 Amendment had to run necessarily upon completion of the comp claim, because otherwise, if he proceeded with the third-party case prior to the comp case, there was an election involved, he would be precluded from recovering comp.
That's no longer the case.
After 1973, that is no longer the case. So for purposes of the claimant's cause of action, those cases are very important. But the comp carrier has a different situation. Their cause of action accrues whenever their payments start.
So the third party, actually the third party defendant, so to speak, let's say the product's liability manufacturer, does not have a two-year statute of limitations for purposes of the subrogation claim. It could be three, four, five, however many years, 2 years plus whatever time that the comp benefits were paid out.
Neither does the drunk driver, Your Honor, and that has always been the law. However, I think you'll see that it does not turn into a in perpetuity problem under the laws dealing with the various scenarios. So we have, number one, the CSA, the ordinary comp claim. Number two, we have the controverted claim, and number three, the death case. This case here before us today is a new situation, contrary to what the Court of Appeals has said, because this is a case that doesn't fit into any of the three categories that courts in this state have reviewed. This is a case involving medical payments made for some period of time, some debate or controversy existing about the medical payments, and the then the comp carrier making an affirmative decision not to fight it, not to controvert it, but instead to pay it and settle it. And the question comes before this court, when does the cause of action accrue? The Court of Appeals could have forged a new rule dealing with this particular scenario, but they did not. Instead, they chose to rewrite 40 years of Texas law, and I submit to you today that this is a most egregious and a fatal blow that's being dealt to the insurance industry.
Fatal?
Fatal in terms of workers' compensation subrogation. I represent TEIA, formed in 1913. I've been their consultant for subrogation for a number of years. I think that was one of their vital mistakes. Their failing has cost our state $245 million, and now my client's the state receiver.
Surely this case is not the beginning of the end of all things.
Oh, no, it's not, Your Honor, but I think there's a subterranean economy of subrogation cases. In fact, I've been before this honorable court before in a subrogation case. You probably didn't even know that that's what it was. They're often disguised, and there's a lot more out there than people are made aware of. And the reason for that is because you sue in the name of the claimant, not the carrier. However, in this case, New York Underwriters made an affirmative decision to pursue this particular avenue, suing in their own name and in the name of Gerald Guillot. And it has been clear in Texas that where you have a normal comp claim, statute of limitations begins to run on the date of the CSA. And I direct you to Brooks versus Lucky, which is a case the Court of Appeals below did not cite nor refer to. In that case, you have an injury occurring in April of 1951. 2 weeks later, you have an indemnity and medical payments made. Almost 8 months later, you have a CSA, which is signed and approved. And just shy of 2 years after the date of the CSA approval, you have a lawsuit filed. Now, the defendant in that case claimed, as the Court of Appeals is submitting here, that the statute of limitations should begin to run on the date of the first payment. The defendant, in support of that proposition in Brooks, cited the case of Buss versus Robeson, as did the Court of Appeals here. But the court pointed out aptly and correctly in the Brooks case that Buss is a death case. And although it is nice to make a comparison because you have the running of payments, the death case has the cause of action accruing on the date of the first payment. That has always been the law in death cases. But the court in Brooks said that is not the law, where you have periodic payments made from point A to point Z, and there are some disputes, and I'll quote the court in Brooks, about the extent and duration of these payments, where they are uncertain, indefinite, incapable of being established in total at the time.
When do you say limitations began to run in this case?
Your Honor, I would submit, and I cannot point you to a case, but I would submit that limitations in this case should begin to run on the date where it reasonably appears that no more payments are going to be made, or where it reasonably appears that the comp carrier is certain of its obligations under the policy. And there are a plethora of reasons why that should be the case.
Let me ask you if that applies to this hypothetical. Assume that a person is injured and does not retain counsel but is paid weekly compensation benefits for 401 weeks until such time as any responsibility of the carrier to make comp payments expires. Is it your contention that the insurance carrier would then have 2 years after the expiration of that 401 weeks in order to sue a third party?
No, Your Honor.
Which would be, by my calculation, close to 10 years.
Okay, the scenario you're citing to me is probably the last and only scenario that hasn't been addressed, and that is very much like this one here, where you have comp benefits that are paid out without being disturbed.
Well, the only time it's paid in a lump sum typically, isn't it, is when there's a CSA, when the injured worker is represented by counsel, or whether there's a trial which reduces that to a lump sum.
That's true. I would submit in a case like that it would reasonably appear to the carrier and to a finder of fact much earlier than 401 weeks after the injury that they were certain of their benefits. The point being,
why should it run just from each payment?
Well, I...
In other words, you'd get payments for the last X years and that's it.
Is your question whether or not that should be the rule? In other words,
yes.
Every payment starts running its own cause of action?
That's my question.
I thought long and hard about whether this court would deal with this situation that way. I don't have a problem with it. However, in reality, in the everyday handling of comp claims, I think it is a problem because workers' compensation carriers traditionally have adjusters who are overworked and overburdened. They make their payments, and at some point they say, hey, we're having a reasonably large claim here. Let's refer it to the Central Recovery Unit. Let's have them file suit and hire an attorney. The problem then there is you are going to, in many, many cases, be throwing away a good sum of money, which is rightfully theirs by statute. The Brooks case essentially said the statute of limitations...
Couldn't that type of argument be made?
Pardon?
Couldn't the argument you just made be made against virtually any limitations case? It might take you a while to realize that you've been hurt so bad when you were involved in an accident. I mean,
it has, Your Honor.
It's just an argument against limitations, isn't it?
Excuse me. Yes, that's true. In Robinson versus Weaver, I mean, it was made successfully. It was made unsuccessfully in many other cases trying to extend the discovery rule. The issue here is that there is a statute which grants specific and peculiar rights to the carrier, including the right of subrogation, and there's a whole body of law talking about whether or not there is a separate cause of action, whether or not they have separate title to file suit, and in fact they do. It is peculiar to most statute of limitations questions which may be addressed by this court.
The statute that you refer to creates a right of subrogation, quote, if compensation is claimed. There are a lot of cases that deal with the election problem, as you mentioned. But apart from that election problem, why shouldn't that language be taken to mean that the right accrues when the claim is made, and that's when limitation starts running?
The statute that you're referring to, the particular portion of 8307-6A, deals with, and as a matter of fact, so does the language paid and assumed used by the Court of Appeals, deals solely with the right to obtain a credit by the comp carrier. The election has done away with any need for the claimant to worry about the statute of limitations. If he doesn't file his third-party case relatively soon after the comp case is filed, he does so at his own danger.
Well, the language I'm referring to pertains broadly to the right of subrogation. The right of subrogation exists if compensation be claimed. The old Brandon case said if you read that statute, you'd think that that meant that the right matures that day. But you'd be fooled because of this election problem.
Let me make a distinction, which is a fine distinction. The Brandon case Your Honor is referring to is a case which deals with whether or not an injured worker who went out and settled with the tortfeasor behind the back of the carrier compromised the carrier's right to subrogation. No payments were made. The sole issue there had to do with accrual and maturing of a cause of action. I would submit that that is totally different than whether or not a two-year statute of limitations begins to run against a workers' compensation carrier when it has no idea what its benefits might be. I have handled cases in which $200 and $300 have been paid out, and 3 years later, someone has to have psychiatric care or something that's attributable to an injury, and as the statute, as you're reading it, might take away subrogation rights before they ever accrue.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Counsel, under your scenario, though, do you concede that the injured worker and the workers' compensation insurance carrier would have different statutes of limitations as pertains to a third-party claim?
Unquestionably.
They would?
Yes.
And although the insurance carrier could certainly intervene in a law for its workers' compensation benefits paid to the injured worker in the claim in the lawsuit against the third party.
Unless you have a case like this where he never filed anything.
And it was could.
And often do.
Okay.
Correct.
Why should we have separate statutes of limitations for the subrogor and the injured party as against third parties?
Because, Your Honor, the actual the meat, if you will, of the issue of the subrogation suit is going to be the payments that have been made or assumed or the liability assumed by the workers' compensation carrier, which may not ever happen in the case of a contested comp claim or a late filing of a comp claim for good cause until 3 years after the accident. And if Mr. Guillot or anyone in his position doesn't file a third-party suit, my client is left in the cold two years and 1 day after the date of accident if they have the same statute of limitations. That's the reason that there has historically never been a statute of limitations running from the date of the accident prior to the 73 amendment. After the amendment, you now have two separate causes of action, accrual dates. And I think the reason for that is fundamentally necessary in this state, not in every state, but in states where it grants the carrier a separate subrogation right.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Wickard, my name is Ross Asher. I'm from Houston. And today I have the honor of being here representing Mr. Vincent Hicks, the respondent. It's important for this court to understand from the outset that there is almost total agreement on every detail concerning the facts of this case. There is no disagreement and no argument that New York underwriters waited more than 2 years after the date of the injury in order to file a lawsuit. Further, there is no disagreement and no argument that New York underwriters waited more than 2 years after they began making payments before they filed a lawsuit. Likewise, there's no question that a two-year statute of limitations applies in a personal injury suit in Texas. The only question is, when does that two-year period begin to run? Petitioners have attempted to distinguish the issue of when a cause of action accrues and when a statute of limitations begins to run. But they must be the same if a statute of limitations is to have any effect. This court has clearly said when a statute of limitations begins to run.
Well, we've had a number of instances where accrual is at a different time than the statute begins to run. Most recently in legal malpractice cases, just a few months old. And we've done it in a lot of good faith, bad faith insurance claims.
Your Honor, this court, though, has made specific exceptions that it has set out. This court has made general statements of the law regarding statute of limitations. And when this court wants to set out a specific exception to those rules, this court has long had the ability and the willingness to do that. This court has not yet set out any exception that says a subrogation suit, an insurance carrier can wait until it knows the extent of its damages in order to file a suit. And that's, no matter how skillfully and cleverly worded petitioner's argument is, that's what petitioner is after. Petitioner is here telling the court that an insurance carrier in workers' comp should be able to wait until it knows the extent of its damages before it files suit. In other words, a comp carrier should be the only plaintiff in this state who can wait until it knows the extent of its damages before it files suit. This court has said that's not the law in Texas. Atkins versus Crossland said that a cause of action sounding in tort accrues in the absence of a statute to the contrary or fraudulent concealment when the tort is committed. This rule obtains notwithstanding the fact that the damages or their extent are not ascertainable until a later date. We don't question the fact that in many compensation cases, a compensation carrier does not always know immediately or even after some period of time has passed what the extent of their damages will be. But that's the rule in many personal injury cases.
Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that limitations started to run when it did, March of 84, I think it was?
The Court of Appeals gave a broader interpretation than we take, Your Honor. It's our position here that the statute of limitations begins to run as to all parties on the date of the accident. That's a 24-month period of limitations from the date of the accident. The Court of Appeals,
how can that be? Because on the date of the accident, the workers' compensation carrier has no claim at all of any nature, subrogation or otherwise.
In that case, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals would be correct because 1 month later, the compensation carrier made its first payment. And so that would extend the statute for effectively a 25-month period instead of a 24-month period in this case. In that case, the Court of Appeals would be correct, but even under that scenario, petitioner's case must fail because they waited almost 36 months after either the date of the accident or the date of the first payment before they filed a lawsuit. The Court of Appeals correctly recognized the reasoning in Brandon that when a carrier assumes to make a payment, they know that they're in a lawsuit. At that point, they have a right to sue. And the law in Texas is that when a party has a right to sue, when facts come into existence that authorize a claimant to seek a judicial remedy, that is when a statute of limitations begins to run. That's when the cause of action accrues. That's the Robinson versus Weaver case.
You can easily imagine a scenario in which the carrier paid 1 week's payments of benefits, discontinued benefits, claim arose, it was litigated, it took a longer period of time to resolve it. Ultimately, it was concluded that benefits were owed, but that was much after 2 years from the first small payment that was made. Under your rule, the carrier would have had to file suit sometime during that two-year period, even though at that point, it had no idea whether it might be obligated or not.
Yeah, that's true, Your Honor, and that puts the compensation carrier in exactly the same boat as every other injured party in Texas. Every other injured party in Texas may have some sort of injury. They may have some manifestation of that injury immediately, seek some treatment, have some damages, and then years later have some reoccurrence, which is directly and provably attributable to that old injury. But it doesn't matter that they now have a new claim. If that statute of limitations period is over with, it's over with. This court should not write law so that the insurance companies of Texas are the only benefits of extended statutes of limitations.
Haven't we already done that in several cases that have been cited?
Brandon, I disagree with the
Brandon case and the Campbell case and others.
I disagree with the applicability of those cases. Although there may be some similar facts, I don't agree that those cases are the cases that this court must look to, nor did the Court of Appeals look to those cases. The Court of Appeals said that Brandon was the controlling case, that Brandon was very clear, and it says that when a carrier assumes to make payments, then it has assumed an obligation. As soon as it pays out money, it knows that for better or for worse, it's in a lawsuit. What we basically have is the case where...
It doesn't know it's in a lawsuit against some third party necessarily. I mean, the insurance company's got a good faith duty to make the payments to the injured worker, irrespective of a third party claim, don't they?
No question about that, Your Honor.
And so why does the payment of benefits due under the workers' compensation policy put anybody on notice that there may be a claim against some third party?
Because the E-1 that's filed in order to initiate a claim has a space where the claimant must state the facts concerning how his injury came into existence. In this case, for example, my client was accused of crossing over the center line, having a head-on accident. There's no question when the carrier received that, they said, hey, we have a third party here that caused this accident. Just like if a worker says, the ladder folded up under me and I fell. The carrier says, there could be a third party action against the manufacturer of the ladder.
So the carrier has to decide if it has a third party action before it ever decides whether or not it owes money under the compensation statute.
It places the same burden on the carrier that every other plaintiff has, Your Honor. Every plaintiff has to decide at some point within a two-year period, does he have a cause of action against someone or not? And that's what I'm asking this court for today, is to simply continue to apply the law that's been applied in Texas so that compensation carriers are not given special privileges. Certainly, Article 8307
does... If I were a third party and a compensation insurance company were suing me for damages while at the same time contesting that they owed any money to the claimant, I would be loath to pay. If my case came to trial first, I would say the company had not suffered any damages if they hadn't paid anything out. Or if they'd paid out 2 weeks of claims, I would hate to pay for 401 weeks on the theory that they were surely going to pay more later.
Well, Your Honor, that's just the case we have here.
If an insurance company is skillful enough, they can recover a judgment against a third party in toto and successfully defend a claim against the claimant and end up with a windfall. Is that right?
That's the same thing that's always happened in comp, Your Honor. Somebody might recover against the compensation carrier. The injured party might recover against the compensation carrier, but not against the third party. There's no guarantee that anyone will recover against everyone against whom he makes claims. These are separate cases.
But that's somewhat different. The standards of liability are different. But the carrier has no right of subrogation at all if it is not owed. If it does not owe benefits to its insurer.
And if it's not paid benefits. And
but
under
why
the fact,
shouldn't it accrue when payments are made? Why
that's
what, when the cause of action accrues?
That's right. What the Court of Appeals said, and certainly we can live with the Court of Appeals decision because under the Court of Appeals decision, which added 1 month to the 2-year statute of limitations that the injured worker would have had, petitioner's cause of action is still defeated. Because
typically, if payments are due, they'll be made within a week. Certainly medical payments be made immediately on the occurrence of an injury requiring medical treatment, will they not? So the insurance company will know right away that the accident has happened. There won't be any real problem there, will it?
And that's why I don't see that. Why there's any problem here, Your Honor. A worker, injured worker is not going to wait a year and a half if he falls off a ladder or if he has a head-on accident, like in this case. It's not going to be a question of 1 year and 11 months after the accident, a claim being filed, and the compensation carrier being up against a wall to all of a sudden decide, does he have to file a lawsuit against some third party? When a worker's injured, claims are made within a short period of time or they're not made at all.
Doesn't the comp law require that notice be given within 30 days?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And a claim filed within 6 months?
And that is a built-in protection which will accrue to the benefit of the compensation carrier.
I don't think there's any validity to this argument about you got to wait you can wait a year and 11 months before you give notice of an industrial accident.
No, I didn't say that, Judge. What I was saying was the compensation carrier doesn't have to worry about that happening. I could see petitioner's argument if that was a fact scenario that could be hanging over the insurance company's head. But it's not hanging over the insurance company's head. The injured worker is under an affirmative duty to file a claim within a certain period of time or else lose his right to make a claim. If he files a claim within that period of time and the compensation carrier makes payments, then the carrier still has plenty of time in which to investigate whether or not there is a valid cause of action against a third-party tortfeasor.
Well, typically, won't the insurance companies and the injured workers' interests be aligned as against the third party?
Normally, because the injured worker may also recover against that third party. Normally, it's not going to be just a subrogation against the third party. It's going to be a third-party personal injury action with the carrier filing an intervention in that case.
Why isn't it a better rule to allow the subrogated carrier to recover all of the payments made in the 2 years preceding the lawsuit, filing of the subrogation claim? Why isn't that a better rule?
Well, that's the rule that the Court of Appeals would have applied, Your Honor.
No, that's not clear. The rule here is that if you don't file suit within 2 years of some payment along the way, you can't recover any of it. But the carrier here made approximately a third of the payments that are being claimed in this case within 2 years of filing the lawsuit.
The court's question.
Why shouldn't it be able to recover those?
Because that opens up every case to dozens and dozens of lawsuits. If the carrier is making weekly payments and each separate payment has its own 2 year statute of limitations, then the carrier can file separate lawsuits for every one of those as it makes them.
But that's no different from a rent situation or any other common installment payment circumstance where, in any event, the carrier's obligation is what its obligation is. It ought to be able to sue at that point and say, these are my damages.
Your Honor, it's my understanding that it's the intention of this court to streamline the work of the courts in this state. And I can see that opening the floodgates to each individual personal injury case having many, many cases filed by a compensation carrier as each payment is made in order to protect the statute of limitations. That would just open a floodgate where there would be a plethora of new cases where there needs to be one case filed for each injury.
That, as Judge Heck points out, that's the rule on rent or on any bank installment loan. But I've never seen a multitude of cases filed, even though that's the existing law in Texas.
But if this court...
There may be amended pleadings filed, but I've yet to see anybody pay a new filing fee each month just to protect their rights as they accrue.
It could occur if the court adopts that rule,
maybe,
though, Your Honor.
It's theoretically there if somebody wants to do it. But your argument that it will clog the courts is not proven true. That I'm aware of, and I'm asking if you're aware of, in situations where there is such a rule.
The petitioners here are attempting to divide the issues of assuming liability in a case and assuming to make payments. There's no question as to when they began or assumed to make payments in this case, but they are saying that they did not assume liability at the same time. What that allows an insurance company to do is make payments as long as they want, for as many years as they want, and then tell the court when they assumed liability and therefore set the running of their own statute of limitations. The purpose of the law is not so that parties can tell the court when a statute of limitations begins to run. The purpose of the law is so the court can tell parties when a statute of limitations has begun. If the court adopts petitioner's argument today, every insurance company making compensation payments can say, certainly we've made payments for 2 weeks, 2 years, 10 years, but we never assumed liability until this certain date. And therefore, that's when our 2 year statute begins to run. We cannot allow parties to have the right to tell the courts when the statutes begin to run. The courts have never allowed that, and this court cannot allow that to happen now. Further, New York Underwriters has no cause of action in its own right here. If it had not made payment to Gerald Guillo, it would not be in this court here today. New York Underwriters' cause of action is purely derivative of the cause of action of Gerald Guillo. As such, New York Underwriters has no fewer, but certainly no more rights than Gerald Guillo. Yet petitioners here asking for a greatly extended and expanded statute of limitations, which would give them more rights than the person to whom they are subrogated. And that's not the way the law works. No matter how petitioners' arguments are worded, they are simply asking this court to let them wait and know what the extent of their damages are. This court has not allowed that to happen. This court has said before that even if you don't know the extent of your damages, you have to file within a statute of limitations. If this court wants to extend the right to New York Underwriters and similar carriers to wait until their damages are fully known, then this court should extend that right to the actual injured party who has suffered the physical damages. That party certainly has greater damages to his own body and his own life than the mere loss of a few dollars. Certainly, New York Underwriters has paid money, and they are entitled under the law to recover that money. But that money does not mean as much to New York Underwriters as the loss of perhaps a limb to an injured worker. If this court is going to allow New York Underwriters and similarly situated carriers to wait until they know the extent of their damages, then this court must, in the interest of justice, extend that same right to all injured parties, especially the actual person who suffered the personal injury and who suffered the greater damages. This court, not only in the interest of justice, but in the interest of continuing to apply the laws that is always applied in this state, must affirm the decision of the 14th Court of Appeals, and for that, respondent is here praying today.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Justice Phillips, you asked the question, why shouldn't the cause of action accrue when the first benefits are paid? I can think of two specific examples, and these are very, very common, where you have an ordinary comp claim. Workers' compensation payments are begun within 7 days after the accident, hopefully sooner. At some point, you have a compromise settlement agreement. But some point during those two periods, there may be some dispute as to whether or not the medicals were related, whether or not there was a prior history that wasn't revealed to the carrier, and oftentimes you have controversy of claims occurring after payments have been made, controversy which may go as far as this honorable court, appealing whether or not something was in course and scope, whether or not the medical was related, whether something was reasonable.
Well, if the medical wasn't related, it wouldn't be related to the automobile accident. It underlies the basic third-party lawsuit anyway to recover from before you're subrogated.
Sure, but it might.
So what does that prove?
Well, because it might be related. And if it is related, Your Honor, we're talking about a large amount of money that the carrier is going to have to pay out and subrogate. But if they wait until they come before this honorable court to determine whether or not it is related, if Justice Phillips' scenario has application, they have kissed goodbye the money that they paid 3, 4, 5 years ago because they aren't going to file a subrogation suit until they know whether or not this honorable court says that $300,000 or $400,000 is related to an accident.
But that's not the case here, though.
No, it is not.
What rule here holds that this cause of action is not barred by limitations? What rule do you contend should be applied here to save this cause of action?
The law of the case decisions of Brooks versus Lucky.
Well, tell us the rule. Tell us the rule.
Well, there is no rule, Your Honor. I'd ask that you fashion a rule, and I would suggest a rule to you.
All right, but it's not paid or assumed to pay.
No, it's not.
All right.
And the case of Thompson versus Graham clearly spells out. In that case, you have a traditional case. You have, Justice Phillips, your scenario. You have payments started on date A, and you have a CSA at the end of a three-year period, and the court held without question, assumption of payments is not the issue, and for good reason. Assumption of liability of payments is the issue, and that occurred on the date of the CSA.
Does the carrier voluntarily assume liability for payments when it makes one?
I'm sorry, could you restate the question?
Doesn't the carrier voluntarily assume liability for a payment when it makes one?
Technically, it does, Your Honor. It assumes liability for a $206 weekly payment.
It can't get it back.
No, it cannot get it back. It can't get it back from the claimant, but it can get it back from some third-party tortfeasor on whom, if the burden of this onerous decision should fall, it should fall on the third-party tortfeasor, not the carrier.
What's the rule then?
Well, the rule should be that of Brooks versus Lucky, and the Court of Appeals has done this state and the insurance industry injustice by essentially overruling Brooks versus Lucky. It has said that even where there is a CSA, the cause of action must accrue on the date of the first payment. Clearly overruling, although not mentioning Brooks versus Lucky.
Tell me, for purposes of this argument, what you think the rule should be that saves this cause of action.
All right, this cause of action, Your Honor, I think accrued for New York underwriters on the date when they reasonably knew or should have known that they had completed making their medical benefit payments.
Yeah, this is a case tried on stipulated facts. When was that date?
The date of the trial?
No, sir. When was the date that under your rule, New York underwriters knew or reasonably should have known that it has what its payments were going to be?
June 29th, 1984.
Which happens to be the date of the last payment.
Correct.
Doesn't that mean there's always going to be a jury trial or some factual dispute as to when that date, when that cause of action accrues?
Your Honor, out of 4,000 cases our firm handled, I've probably had a dozen motions for summary judgment based on the statute of limitations, because we preach to get these things filed quickly. We have won every one, and maybe half of those, there may be a jury trial on the issue of statute of limitations, but it would be tried along with the case.
Well, it's like the discovery rule, isn't it? When they knew or reasonably should have known that they had a cause of action, isn't that basically what you're advocating is the engrafting of the discovery rule on limitations here?
I'd like to name it something else, but yes, Your Honor, I'm asking.
Same standard.
It is the same standard for this case. But don't forget, we have three other types of comp claims that have for 40 years been engraved and engrafted in Texas law as to when the cause of action accrues, and this Court of Appeals has essentially done away with all of them except the death case. And if you do nothing else, please save the causes of action that carriers have on these cases with CSAs and contests of compensability after numerous payments have been made. The Court of Appeals has essentially dealt them that death blow with respect to those causes of action. But to follow up, in answer to the question, the cause of action should accrue when it reasonably appears to the carrier that their obligations are through, or when the total of their payments have been made. And for that reason, I'd ask.
What about a case then where you got lifetime medical that you got to pay for? That's limitations doesn't start to run until that person lives out his lifetime.
No, it does. Excuse me for interrupting. It does, Your Honor. In total and permanent cases, and they're rare.
I'm talking about total and permanent. I'm talking about lifetime medical.
That's total and permanent.
No, it doesn't have to be total and permanent.
Well,
lifetime medical.
Okay. Death cases, Your Honor. We admit that the statute...
Not talking about death cases. I'm talking about lifetime medical for injuries.
Oh, okay.
Received in an industrial accident. Let's say the worker is 20 years old. He gets injured. And the expectation is he's going to require medical attention the rest of his life. He's got a life expectancy of 45 or 50 years. He continues to seek and receive that medical treatment. You continue to pay the medical benefits as you're obligated to under the comp law.
Correct.
Statute of limitations doesn't start running until that fellow dies.
No, I think that would be an absurd rule. I think the rule...
Tell me about your rule and where that doesn't make it.
Well, assuming no other facts...
Well, that's the inevitable result.
Well, respectfully, Judge, I disagree. Given no other facts in your scenario, you're going to have a non-contested case. And if in our situation we had agreed that medical was going to be paid out, we would continue to pay it out. Where there is some dispute, and in fact there's a finding of fact in this case that on April 21, 1984, we weren't certain of our obligations, and there was debates going on as to whether or not dental work was as a result of the injury, you may have a fact question for the jury. In an ordinary case, medical continues for life. The cause of action should still accrue on the date when the carrier reasonably knew of its obligations under the policy.
And the extent of its obligation.
and the extent of its obligation. This is not an easy rule to deal with. However, the three scenarios that we have dealt with up over the last 40 years are there. They're part of Texas law. Save those from the jaws of the Court of Appeals. With regard to the medical...
Let me ask a follow-up on Judge Mazzi's question. Under current law, as you see it, once you accept that you owe this lifetime medical, then the cause of action starts running.
Absolutely.
And then you can sue the third party, and you sue for the estimated amount of what that medical is going to be reduced to present value. Is that correct?
Well, what you do, Your Honor, we only have the right as a comp carrier to sue for the actual past benefits paid.
For what? So you have a... You would, under that scenario, have at least every 2 years have to amend your pleadings or file a new lawsuit.
Well, here's why this is a strange situation, because the Comp Act allows me to sue for an infinite amount of damages, but I'm only allowed to recoup the amount of past benefits paid, and anything above and beyond that goes to Mr. Guillot, and it constitutes a credit to the carrier, and that's where we get into the words paid and assumed, and I think we're taking out of context.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. And the second call, the court will take a 9-3 recess.